destiny was in the hands of God.
The Essay.
Now that was a good king.
Weeknights on BBC Radio 3 at 10:45.
Back to this Sunday lunchtime in a couple of minutes, today's early music show. But now, with the time just gone 1 o'clock, the news read by Ian Skelly.
Five Royal Marines have been charged with the murder of an insurgent in Afghanistan last year. They were arrested last week after police found suspicious video footage on the laptop of a man they were investigating on an unrelated matter. Four other Marines have been released without charge. The Ministry of Defence is reviewing the access to ministers and officials that former army officers are given following newspaper allegations about a number of retired generals. The Sunday Times says they boasted of being able to use their influence to help private firms win lucrative contracts. The men involved have denied wrongdoing, but the Defence Secretary Philip Hammond has called the revelations deeply damaging. Mr. Hammond has also said he wants the Territorial Army to change its name and become an integral part of the regular army. He said the Army Reserve would have regular army uniforms and equipment, and that each battalion would be twinned with a regular battalion. The Justice Secretary, Chris Grayling, says the BBC has lessons to learn from the scandal surrounding Jimmy Savile. The police are investigating around 60 allegations of abuse spanning more than four decades. Mr. Grayling added that the corporation had acted correctly in announcing two separate investigations into what happened. The campaign group Human Rights Watch has accused Syria of a significant increase in its use of cluster bombs against civilians. It says it's monitored online videos purporting to show up to 20 cluster bomb strikes across Syria in the past week, compared with three over the previous 18 months. Britain's most prestigious architecture award, the Stirling Prize, has been given to a plant research centre in Cambridge. The Sainsbury Laboratory beat buildings like the Olympic Stadium in London and the Hepworth Art Gallery in Wakefield to the £20,000 prize. And the weather, most places will remain dry and cool with sunny spells throughout the rest of the day. There'll be scattered showers near coastal areas, which will spread across southwestern parts later. And that's the BBC News and the weather. It's 2:30 past one.
And it was read by Ian Skelly. Well, time now on Radio 3 for today's early music show. As part of the Piano on the BBC season, Lucy Skeeping presents the second of two programmes about the period piano.
Welcome to the early music show and our second programme this weekend that's part of the piano season here on the BBC. If you were listening yesterday at this time, you'll have heard about the very beginnings of the piano, its invention, if you like, at the Medici court in Italy around 1700, and how it differed from the old harpsichord in that instead of little quills plucking the strings, the notes were produced by hammers hitting the strings. And as the piano began to gain in interest and popularity, I left you with a bit of a cliffhanger about the two main schools of piano making in the 18th century, the Viennese school and the English. Which was better and which eventually won the battle to become the basis of the modern piano? Well, more of that later. But first, we're going to look in more detail at the difference between the two schools. Here's Stephen Devine, Professor of Fortepiano at Trinity College of Music.
The Viennese piano is a very light-cased instrument. Effectively, you have an instrument in an outer case so that the sides of the instrument don't really contribute to the sound production. An English instrument is a solid box and the outer case is quite thick. It owes a lot more to sort of contemporary harpsichord design. This basically means that the English piano is more resonant, if you like, because more of the wood of the actual instrument is created within the sound. And composers exploited this, and they demand these large pedal open effects, this great sonority, and it's just an exploitation of the English piano sound, this very light damping, this very washy sound, for want of a better word. The Viennese piano, right throughout this period, has very exacting dampers that fit between the strings, so you have absolute clarity. You can create amazing sort of clear effects. I always think of them as crystalline sort of textures in late Mozart, early Beethoven, and that in itself is one of the things that need to be taken on board when you approach an early instrument. Actually, the composer probably wanted that.
So it's the difference in the construction of these instruments, not just in the way the strings work, but in the actual wooden casings as well. Let's hear an example of a Viennese piano first. This is the first movement of Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 15 in B-flat, and it's performed here on Mozart's own piano, made by Anton Walter in around 1780.
Thank you.
first movement of Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 15 in B-flat, with Robert Levin playing Mozart's own Viennese forte piano made by Anton Walter. The orchestra was the Academy of Ancient Music, conducted by Christopher Hogwood. Well, it's a complex process, the way the sound of a forte piano is produced. And there are also differences between the Viennese instruments and the English ones when it comes to the action, the way the hammers hit the strings, as Stephen Devine explains.
On Viennese instruments, the hammers are mounted directly on the keys. We may think that's true of any piano, but actually, if you look in a modern instrument and an early English instrument, the hammers are suspended on a frame. And as you press a key, a jack, a bit like a harpsichord jack, comes up and hits the hammer itself and then sets the hammer off. So you're not actually controlling the hammer set off directly. On a Viennese instrument, you lift the hammer by pressing the key, and the back of the hammer is then caught at the back, and then the hammer is flipped up. So you have a much greater degree of control of the actual speed, every aspect of the speed of a hammer on a Viennese action instrument. I think this is why a lot of composers talked about the perfection of the Viennese instrument, because it allowed you this greater variety of dynamic range within a certain band. And you do feel a lot more as though you're making the sound yourself. Obviously, you don't have quite the same feeling when you play an English instrument and, by extrapolation, a modern instrument.
Stephen Devine. Well, we've heard an example of a Viennese piano. In fact, we heard the instrument that actually belonged to Mozart himself. So now let's explore a bit more about the English school. And one of the most important figures here is Johann Christoph Zumper. OK, he wasn't actually English by birth. He was born in Nuremberg, but he moved to London in the 1760s, where he began making small or square pianos, as they were called, and with great success.
Zumper is a fascinating case because he is one of the earliest examples we have of square pianos. Zumper was one of a group of Germans who were working in London. They really pioneered this idea of the square piano as a domestic instrument, and this is what kind of kick-started the whole piano domestic revolution. Zumper is known to have known Johann Christian Bach, because we have a description of J.C. Bach playing a concert on an instrument by Zumper in the Devonshire Rooms from the mid-1760s. The instruments that survived by Zumper are generally fairly small, very portable, and rather quiet. So the thought of doing a concert on them is quite strange to our ears, but maybe it was a small room, we don't know, and maybe it was a very sort of intimate concert.
Thank you.
the second movement of J.C. Bach's Concerto in E-flat, Opus 7, No. 5. David Owen Norris was playing an original Zumpa square piano from 1769, accompanied by Sonnery, Monica Huggett and Amelia Benjamin on violins with the cellist Joseph Crouch. Well, according to Stephen Devine, the square piano was a revolution.
If you lived in a small flat in London, you could have one of these in the corner of your room. You could eat your dinner off it, and then after dinner you lifted the lid and there you had your after-dinner entertainment. It was a fantastic commercial success.
Apart from its size, though, no doubt another reason for its success was the affordable price of Zumpa's square pianos, which was about half that of a single manual harpsichord. Another London-based instrument maker with a canny eye on the bottom line was Muzio Clementi.
Clementi instruments were made by a man who could seriously play as well as took a great interest in the actual instrument. I think that has a unique bearing on the instrument creation. Clementi took over a company called Collard & Collard, a very established, very successful English piano company already, and he developed a certain type of instrument, mostly down to the decoration and how they were finished, but also down to little specifics like he would put a certain compass, a certain keyboard range on, and then write music for that certain keyboard range that was impossible to play on instruments by his rivals. He sent a brand new piano out, and when the new piano was unpacked at the other end at the customer's house, out fell a lot of brand new music by Clementi, and we know from a letter back to his foreman, he said, don't forget to include the invoice for the music. So he was clearly a great businessman, great wit, and just a very good all-round sort of musician. He was looking at every aspect of the instrument.
Well, that sounds like an excellent marketing strategy. As soon as you unwrapped your brand new piano, you could try it out with some of Clementi's own music. Pieces like these two, perhaps. They're called Monferratos, based on traditional Italian dance tunes. In the first one, about 30 seconds in, listen out for a rather strange-sounding passage. Well, strange to modern ears, anyway. The dampers are raised at this point, the same effect as pressing down the sustaining pedal on a modern piano. But here, they're kept raised for the whole section, which creates a rather striking sort of ethereal effect. two short pieces by the piano maker and composer Muzio Clementi, played there by John Cury on an original Clementi grand piano. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Lucy Skeeping, and we're tracing the history of the piano today. Well, in my own family home as a child, we had a very pretty piano by the English maker John Broadwood, a baby grand that took pride of place in the drawing room and took a regular bashing for many hours each day under the hands of my jazz-playing father. I guess that's not quite what that illustrious piano company might have imagined back in the late 1700s when Haydn, for instance, first came across their instruments. Here's Stephen Devine again.
Broadwood's the oldest surviving piano company still in existence. They were the most successful company at the time, or certainly one of the most successful companies. One of the reasons for their success was that they were working hand in hand with players all the time and creating an instrument that worked very well for players. So players really liked this style of instrument. In a lot of cases, there wasn't very much case decoration or extra gadgets, extra effects. But the instruments themselves worked well. They were beautifully made from the action point of view and at the forefront of string development technology. They were always working out ways of creating a good sound. So they're constantly innovating. And I think this must have been wonderful for Haydn to come over and see this instrument that would have been very different from the instruments he knew in Vienna. As a famous musician, he was bound to have met all the great piano makers, and he must have met the Broadwood directors in the company, and I'm sure would have been very taken by the quality and the sound. And the potential that they offered him really clearly inspired him to make all these different technical challenges in his late sonatas. There's a wonderful passage in the C major sonata where he talks about opening the pedal for a long period of time, again exploiting this washy English piano sound. And then these big, thick chords that start the E-flat sonata, that crunchy, very sort of rich, resonant sound of the English instrument. Thank you.
Malcolm Bilson played the first movement of Haydn's so-called London Sonata. Bilson writes about how very distinctive these English pianos are and how he found what he calls their London sound nothing short of a revelation, he says, after spending 40 years playing the same piece on a Viennese piano. It was this sort of declamatory style of the English piano, he says, that inspired Haydn, compared with the more intimate style of the Viennese pianos that were part of Mozart's sound world. So it's time to find out the result of the battle in the 18th century between these two competitive piano schools. And the winner, I'm proud and a little patriotic to announce, was the English school.
The Viennese piano died out fairly soon into the 19th century, certainly as a major force, simply because it couldn't create the volume needed to fill large concert halls. On the other hand, it was a perfected instrument. The English piano of Broadwood, Clementi, etc., developed into the modern grand we know and love today. But one wasn't necessarily better than the other. It doesn't mean the English piano was better than the Viennese piano, because, as we know, many composers preferred the Viennese action. This is shown by the fact that the Viennese action was actually requested in many instruments, and we know that Bösendorfer created an instrument with a Viennese action right up to about the end of the 19th century, which is virtually a modern grand.
Actually, when it comes to preferences between the two types of pianos, the Viennese or the English, Beethoven is an interesting case. Like Mozart, he played and wrote for pianos with a Viennese action, but later in life it seems that he began working with English instruments.
We also know that Beethoven had an affinity for English pianos, and I suspect, again, if he's going a little bit deaf and he's wanting tone and sound, it's because they had a louder, richer resonant sound and were probably more suited to his hearing possibilities and the music he was wanting to create at that time. So we know that he had a good relationship with the Broadwood Company. They sent him an instrument, and he had fairly strong ties with England for one reason or another. And so he knew his English instruments as well. And I think that dictates the style of music he writes towards the mid-period of his life, if not later on.
Stephen Devine. So, would it be correct to say that the piano had reached its modern form by Beethoven's time? Well, not quite. Today's best pianos are what you call overstrung, which means that the bass strings are stretched across the piano casing diagonally, either over or under the treble strings, which gives a richer bass sound. In Beethoven's day, though, the strings were still positioned parallel to each other, so the treble and bass sounds were more or less equal. According to the pianist Robert Levin, this parallel type of stringing has an important effect when playing, say, a Beethoven piano sonata on a period instrument compared with a modern instrument.
On an overstrung piano, like all of the pianos made today, if you want to have a successful performance, you have to bring out the voice that's important and suppress everything else. And the accompaniment figures, as glorious as they may be, are usually about half the volume of the top. And everybody is completely used to this. But on parallel strung pianos, it's unnecessary. If you play the beginning of the Waldstein Sonata on a period piano and play all of those crackling little quavers at exactly the same volume from top to bottom, it sounds fantastic and the top voice is very, very clear. If you do the same thing on an overstrung piano, what you discover is that you need to bring out the top melody. If you do that on a period piano, the audience seems to react, well, we're not idiots, you know. We do know what the tune is. You don't have to help us so much. So, you know, there are these things that can be learned. When you play the Beethoven Waldstein Sonata on an instrument of his time, you become astounded by not only how different the utterance is, but the gradual realization of how ideal that particular instrument actually is for Beethoven's sonic design. So many people will say, oh, Beethoven hated those pianos, and if he had a Steinway, he would have been thrilled with it. And the only answer to that could be, it's quite possible that Beethoven would have been thrilled with a Steinway. I could well imagine that he was, but to the extent that he would write the same music for the Steinway that he wrote for the instrument at hand, to that extent he would be a wretched composer. You know, it would be like a Savile Row tailor who made the sleeves too long and the pants too short.
Thank you.
first movement of Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 21 in C, the Waldstein, played on a period instrument by Bart van Oort. I guess in early music terms, at any rate, Beethoven feels quite recent. But I do feel that if we really want to understand what Beethoven had in mind and why he wrote certain phrases the way he did, then it is important to bear in mind and keep a link with the performance practice of his own time and the sort of instruments that were available to him. Let's give the last word to Robert Levin.
There will be a time when Beethoven is just as old as, say, Josquin des Prez is now. And we don't know, if we haven't blown ourselves to bits in the 23rd or 24th century, how people will react to Beethoven unless there's a wonderful chain of expressive danger and urgency that continues to link Beethoven with the music of tomorrow.
The pianist Robert Levin, ending the early music show, which was part of the BBC Piano Season. The programme was presented by Lucy Skeeping and produced in Salford by Nick Holmes. And the Piano Season continues this evening in this week's edition of Words and Music.
This hallucination standing on three legs, this curious beast with its enormous moonlit smile.
The Piano Season on BBC Radio 3 continues with a special edition of Words and Music. Love, loss, nostalgia, determination and joy, all inspired by the piano.
I regret that before a people can be reformed, they have to be sinners. And that before you have pianists in the family, you have to have beginners.
Words by Ogden Nash, D.H. Lawrence, William Shakespeare and Jane Austen. And music that is just as transporting. Words and Music, tonight at 6:30.
It's just gone 2 o'clock and time now this afternoon on BBC Radio 3. For this week's Sunday Concert.
Og så er vi ved at være klar her med koncerten, og det er allerførst, som sagt, BBC Singers, som vil besøge musik af Thomas Tallis, en af satserne fra hans Missa Salve Intimerata Gloria. Og så to motetter af...
No, don't worry, your radio hasn't retuned itself. That was Danish presenter Mette Greifenberg. Introducing this afternoon's concert for listeners to Danish radio last Tuesday night. The concert was given in the Garrison Church, Copenhagen, as part of the BBC Singers' short tour of Sweden and Denmark. And thanks to our colleagues in Danish radio, we're able to broadcast a recording of it now. The BBC Singers were conducted by David Hill, and their programme was given as part of Music Around, a festival in Denmark and southern Sweden. The festival's theme this year is, perhaps unsurprisingly, London. And so the Singers' programme features music by composers associated with London and includes the premiere of a substantial new work by Gabriel Jackson, which has been inspired by the sights and sounds of the capital itself. More on that later. This first part of the concert looks back to 16th century London, and its focus is an elaborate setting of the Mass by Thomas Tallis. The Missa Salve Intemerata can't be precisely dated, but it's thought to have been composed in the 1530s. Tallis was organist of St Mary at Hill in London around 1537, when the church was famous for its music, so perhaps this Mass was composed for St Mary's choir. We'll hear the movements of Tallis's Mass paired with music by his great English contemporary William Byrd and by two Danish composers of the period. The BBC Singers first of all here in the Gloria of Tallis's Mass and following on from it two motets by Mogens Pedersen, born in 1585, the year of Tallis's death. Ad te levavi oculi sets the opening of Psalm 121. I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills, from whence cometh my help. And after it a motet setting words from Psalm 148. Laudate Dominum de Caelis. Praise ye the Lord from the heavens.